kids. And I do wish to be careful how I negotiate the minefield of the learning disabled and the developmentally disadvantaged. In other words, those with special needs. All of these being more examples of this tiresome and ridiculous language. I just want to talk about kids who are stupid, not the ones with dings. One of the terms now used to describe these stupid kids is minimally exceptional. Can you handle that? Minimally exceptional. Whatever happened to the old reliable explanation, the boy is slow? Was that so bad? Really? The boy is slow. Some of the other children are quick. They think quickly. Not this boy. He's slow. It seems humane enough to me, but no. He's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. We thought he was just kind of, I don't know, slow. But minimally exceptional, wow. Wait till I tell our friends. Political correctness cripples discourse, creates ugly language, and is generally stupid. I haven't quite finished this section. I'm sure I needn't remind you PC people that the opera isn't concluded until the full-figured woman offers her vocal rendering. I know, I really had to strain to get that in. I'm thoroughly ashamed. But before I leave this section, I wanted to make the point that on a practical level, this language renders completely useless at least one perfectly good expression. In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king becomes, in the kingdom of the visually impaired, the partially sighted person is fully empowered. Sad, isn't it? I've noticed that when people speak these days, location seems important to them, and one location in particular, there. They say such things as, don't go there, been there, done that, and you were never there for me. They don't say much about here. If they do mention here, they usually say, I'm out of here, which is really an indirect way of mentioning there, because if they're out of here, then they must be going there, even though they were specifically warned not to. It seems to me that here and there present an important problem, because when you get right down to it, those are the only two places we have, which, of course, is really neither here nor there. So, let's first talk about don't go there. As we all know, painfully by now, when you mention something someone thinks you shouldn't go into any further, they say, don't go there. What they fail to realize, of course, is that technically, by the time they've told you not to go there, it's too late. You're already there, because you've already mentioned whatever it is they're uncomfortable with. At a time like that, what they should be saying is, don't stay there. Or, at the very least, please hurry back. Sort of like, wish you were here. The only time I would tell someone don't go there is if they told me they were planning a trip to Iraq. If someone said, we're going on our honeymoon to Fallujah, I would immediately say, don't go there. By the way, when one of those TV newsmen on MSNBC recently tried to get his co-anchor lady to react to some juicy celebrity rumor, she said to him, I am so not going there. And I thought, why am I allowing a person like this to bring me the news? Another phrase I don't care for is been there, done that. I personally am not so cocky. I prefer the modest approach. Instead of been there, done that, I will usually say, been nearby, done something similar. And by the way, most people don't seem to know the complete expression. I heard Drew Barrymore say it on The Tonight Show. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. It's a little smarter, and it hasn't been overused yet. Staying with this subject of location, when someone is ending a long-term relationship, quite often they'll tell the other party, you were never there for me. Here again, what they may be forgetting is that possibly at some time in the past, they had told that very same person, don't go there. So how can they blame the person for not being there when they themselves had issued specific instructions not to go there in the first place? It seems unfair. Additionally, many people who are ending relationships use another bothersome phrase, moving on. They'll say, I found Steve in bed with a carnival worker and they were doing unpleasant things to a chipmunk, so I'm moving on. And I think to myself, actually, Steve sounds more like the one who's moving on. Well, they might say, I'm leaving Armando. He beat me up yesterday in the frozen food section of the supermarket. He struck me in the head repeatedly with a Stouffer's Lean Cuisine. I believe it was the chicken cordon bleu. I'm moving on. Occasionally, I get impatient with these people. When they tell me they're moving on, I look at my watch and say, well, isn't it about time you got started? No sense standing around here talking to me when you could be out there moving on. I don't know. I guess it all works out, because when I run into the same person a few months later, they usually say, I'm in a whole different place now. And I don't think they're referring to Pittsburgh. And by the way, speaking of geographic locations, why is San Francisco always said to be in the Bay Area while Saudi Arabia is in the Gulf region? Is a region really bigger than an area? And what about a belt? How big is a belt? The Bible Belt is bigger than the Borscht Belt. Maybe that's because there are more Christians than Jews. But that doesn't explain the Rust Belt. In the last several decades, a good deal of the U.S. population has moved from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt. People changed belts. By the way, part of the Sun Belt runs right through the Bible Belt. That must be confusing. And let's not forget zones, especially war zones. The media liked that phrase. If there's any kind of explosion at all, even a small gas heater, they'll say the living room looked like a war zone. Most of the time, it's an overstatement, because when you get right down to it, the only thing that looks like a war zone is a combat area. Then there's the opposite of a war zone, a demilitarized zone. Korea has one of those, separating the North and South. A demilitarized zone sounds like a good idea, but I've noticed that wherever they have a demilitarized zone, there are always a lot of soldiers nearby. I guess that's in case the demilitarized zone suddenly becomes a combat area. Now, the Gulf region has been both a war zone and a combat area. That's because there were some countries who wanted to expand their spheres of influence, and also because of the big oil companies, who of course are in the private sector. The private sector is quite different from the public arena. Dick Cheney was in the private sector. Then he moved to the public arena, although many of his acts in the public arena have benefited his interests in the private sector. Getting back a little closer to my own experience, on a recent visit to my hometown, New York City, I was walking through the area that we used to call the Garment District. I noticed that the local trade association now wanted people to call it the Fashion Center. Not everyone wanted that, just the ones who would like to raise the rents. Fashion Center is another example of how desperately people feel the need to upgrade themselves. They just want to feel better. They want to expand their comfort zones. Your comfort zone is not the same as your zone of privacy, by the way. A few years ago, when the press was hounding Congressman Gary Condit about Chandra Levy's disappearance, he asked them to please grant him a zone of privacy. But of course they couldn't do that, because Gary Condit was in the public arena. And as I wind up our little journey through location land, I regret not getting to one other place. Where? And if you wonder where I'm going with this, it's because you don't know where I'm coming from. Or maybe you simply don't know where it's at. Either way, I'm leaving now. I need my space. When people mention term limits to me, I usually tell them the only politicians' terms I would like to limit are the ones they use when speaking. They have an annoying language of their own. And I understand it's necessary for them to speak this way, because I know how important it is that as they speak, they not inadvertently say something. And according to the politicians themselves, they don't say things. They indicate them.
As I indicated yesterday, and as I indicated to the president.
And when they're not indicating, they're suggesting.
The president has suggested to me that as I indicated yesterday.
Sometimes instead of indicating or suggesting, they're outlining or pointing things out.
The president outlined his plan to me, and in doing so, he pointed out that he has not yet determined his position.
Politicians don't decide things. They determine them. Or they make judgments. That's more serious.
When the hearings conclude, I will make a judgment. Or I may simply give you my assessment. I don't know. I haven't determined that yet. But when I do, I will advise the president.
They don't tell, they advise. They don't answer, they respond. They don't read, they review. They don't form opinions, they determine positions. And they don't give advice, they make recommendations.
I advise the President that I will not make a judgment until he has given me his assessment. Thus far, he hasn't responded. Once he responds to my initiative, I will review his response, determine my position, and make my recommendations. And so it is at long last that after each has responded to the other's initiatives, and after they have reviewed their responses, made their judgments, determined their positions, and offered their recommendations, they begin to approach the terrifying possibility that now they may actually be required to do something. Of course, that would be far too simple. So, rather than doing something, they address the problem. We're addressing the problem, and we will soon proceed to take action. Those are big activities in Washington, proceeding and taking action. But you may have noticed that as they proceed, they don't always take action. Sometimes they simply move forward. Moving forward is another one of their big activities. We're moving forward with respect to Social Security. With respect to is lawyer talk, makes things sound more important, complicated. So they're not moving forward on Social Security. They're moving forward with respect to Social Security. But at least they're moving forward. To help visualize this forward motion, you may wish to picture the blistering pace of the land tortoise. Now, sometimes when they themselves are not moving forward, they're moving something else forward, namely the process. We're moving the process forward so we can implement the provisions of the initiative. Implement means put into effect, and an initiative is similar to a proposal. It's not quite a measure yet, but there's a possibility it may become a resolution. Now, one might ask, why do we need all these initiatives, proposals, measures, and resolutions? Well, folks, it should be obvious by now, we need them in order to meet today's challenges. As I'm sure you've noticed, our country no longer has problems. Instead, we face challenges. We're always facing challenges. That's why we need people who can make the tough decisions. Tough decisions like, how much money can I raise in exchange for my integrity so I can be reelected and continue to work in government? Of course, no self-respecting politician would ever admit to working in government. They prefer to think of themselves as serving the nation. This is one of the more grotesque distortions to come out of Washington. They say, I'm serving the nation, and they characterize their work as public service. To help visualize this service they provide, you may wish to picture the activities that take place on a stud farm. Continuing this little review of the language of the elected, it seems that linguistically, politicians hit their truest stride when they find themselves in trouble. At times like these, the explanations typically begin with a single word, miscommunication. How do you answer these felony charges, Senator? The whole thing was a miscommunication. But what about the tapes? They took them out of context. They twisted my words. Nice touch. A person who routinely spends his time bending and torturing the English language, telling us that someone has twisted his words. But as the problem gets worse and his troubles increase, he's forced to take his explanation in a new direction. He now tells us that the whole thing has been blown out of proportion. And by the way, have you ever noticed with these blown-out-of-proportion people that it's always the whole thing? Apparently, no one has ever claimed that only a small part of something has been blown out of proportion. But as time passes and the evidence continues to accumulate, our hero suddenly changes direction and begins using public relations jujitsu. He says, we're trying to get to the bottom of this. We. Suddenly, he's on the side of the law. We're trying to get to the bottom of this so we can get the facts out to the American people. Nice. The American people. Always try to throw them in. It makes it sound as if you actually care. As the stakes continue to rise, our hero now makes a subtle shift and says, I'm willing to trust in the fairness of the American people. Clearly he's trying to tell us something. That there may just be a little fire causing all the smoke. But notice, he's still at the I-have-nothing-to-hide stage. But then, slowly, I'm willing to trust in the fairness of the American people progresses to there is no credible evidence. And before long, we're hearing the very telling, no one has proven a thing. Now, if things are on track in this drama, and the standard linguistic path of the guilty is being followed faithfully, no one has proven a thing will precede the stage when our hero begins to employ that particularly annoying technique,
Ask yourself questions and then answer them.
Did I show poor judgment? Yes. Was there inappropriate behavior? Yes. Do I wish this never happened? Of course. But did I break the law? That's not the issue.
The calendar is marching, however, and it soon becomes clear that our friend is most likely quite guilty indeed. We know this because now he shifts into that sublime use of the passive voice. Mistakes were made. The beauty of mistakes were made is that it doesn't really identify who made them. You're invited to think what you wish. Bad advice? Poor staff work? Voodoo curse? But it's too late. Mistakes were made quickly becomes eventually I will be exonerated, which then morphs into I have faith in the American judicial system. And the progression ends with that plaintive cry, whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? Whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? Well, he's about to find out. Eventually, in full retreat and federal custody, he shuffles off in his attractive orange jumpsuit and can be heard muttering that most modern of mea culpas, I just want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life. And to emphasize how sincere he is, he announces, I'm taking responsibility for my actions. How novel. Imagine taking responsibility. He says it as though it were a recently developed technique. Whenever I hear that sort of thing on the news, I always want to ask one of these I'm taking responsibility for my actions people whether or not they'd be willing to take responsibility for my actions. You know, gambling debts, paternity suits, outstanding warrants. Can you help me out here, pal? Regarding this whole put this thing behind me idea in general, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to put this, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life thing behind me and get on with my life. May I repeat that for you? I'd like to put this, I want to put this thing behind me and get on with my life thing behind me and get on with my life. I think one of the problems in this country is that too many people are screwing things up, committing crimes, and then getting on with their lives. What is really needed for public officials who shame themselves is ritual suicide, harakiri, like those Japanese business executives who mismanage corporations into bankruptcy, never mind the lawyers and the public relations and the press conferences. Get that big knife out of the kitchen drawer and do the right thing. To take up a thread from an earlier section of this politico-lingo trilogy, we noted at the time the fact that most politicians operate under the delusion that what they're doing is serving the nation. Of course, if they really feel this way, they're more than simply misinformed. They're obviously not playing with a full bag of jacks. So, citizens, a question. Do you think it's at all possible that these politicians whose judgment is so faulty that they actually believe they're serving the nation might be expected to indulge occasionally in some, exaggerated patriotism? Huh? What do you think? Maybe? Huh? Well, fans, it's not just possible, it's downright inevitable. And should they be so indulging themselves on the 4th of July, you'll want to be sure to have hip boots and a shovel handy, because brown stuff is going to be piling up at an alarming rate. And I suggest you shovel fast, because your elected heroes will be squeezing every last ounce of counterfeit patriotism out of their blood-starved brains. And so, as you see them rushing madly across the landscape, pushing all the buttons marked red, white, and blue, be on the alert for phrases such as Old Glory, Main Street, the Stars and Stripes, the Heartland, all across this great land of ours, from Maine to California, and of course, on American soil. And don't forget all those freedom-loving people around the world who look to us as a beacon of hope. Those, I assume, would be the ones we haven't bombed lately. And you'd also better be ready to be reminded over and over that you live in a country that somehow fancies itself leader of the free world. Got that? Leader of the free world. I don't know when we're going to retire that stupid shit, but personally, I've heard it quite long enough. 'Cause what exactly is the free world anyway? I guess it would depend on what you consider the non-free world. And I can't find a clear definition of that, can you? Where is that? Russia? China? For Christ's sakes, Russia has a better mafia than we do now. And China is pirating Lion King DVDs and selling dildos on the internet. They sound pretty free to me. Here are some more jingoistic variations you need to be on the lookout for. The greatest nation on earth. The greatest nation in the history of the world. And the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. That last one is usually thrown in just before we bomb a bunch of brown people, which is every couple of years. And bombing brings me to the language used by politicians when referring to our armed forces. Now, normally, during peacetime, politicians will refer to members of the military as our young men and women around the world. But since we're so rarely at peace for more than 6 months at a time, during wars, Senator Patriot and his colleagues are fully prepared to raise the stakes. By the way, don't you just love that word, colleagues? It makes them sound so, I don't know, legitimate. And so it is that in times of combat, our young men and women around the world quickly become our brave young fighting men and women stationed halfway around the world in places whose names they can't pronounce. And for added emotional impact, they may also mention that these military folks spend a lot of time wondering if they'll ever see their loved ones again. That one gets people right in the belly button. And should the speaker be going for maximum emotional effect, he will deliver the above passage, substituting sons and daughters for men and women. And isn't that reference, places whose names they can't pronounce, a lovely little piece of subtle racism? That's an all-American red meat bonus they throw in for you. Here's another way politicians express their racist geographic chauvinism. Young men and women stationed in places the average American can't find on a map. I've always thought it was amusing, and a bit out of character, for a politician to go out of his way to point out the limited amount of intelligence possessed by the American people, especially since his job security depends on that very same limitation. It would also appear to contradict that other well-traveled and inaccurate standby. The American people are a lot smarter than they're given credit for. Amazingly, politicians have mastered the art of uttering those words with a perfectly straight face, even though the proposition is stated precisely backward. Judging from the results of focus groups, polls, and election returns that I've seen, and watching the advertising directed at Americans, I'd say the American people are a lot dumber than they're given credit for. As one example, just look at the individuals they keep sending to their state houses and to Washington to represent them. Look also at what they've done to their once beautiful country and its once beautiful landscape. Wrapping up this modest review of patriotic political language, I think it's safe to conclude that the degree of a politician's insincerity can best be measured by how far around the world our soldiers are and whether or not any of them is able to pronounce the name of the place, and whether or not their neighbors back home can find it on a map. I get weary of this zero-tolerance bullshit. It's annoying. Zero tolerance. To begin with, it's a fascist concept. It's what Hitler and Stalin practiced. It allows for no exceptions or compassion of any kind. All is black and white, no gradations. But even more important, it doesn't solve anything. The use of such a slogan simply allows whichever company, school, or municipality is using it to claim they're doing something about a problem, when in fact, nothing is being done at all, and the problem is being ignored. It's a cosmetic non-solution designed to impress simpletons. Whenever you hear the phrase zero tolerance, remember, someone is bullshitting you. Dempsey's Department Store, drop in today. Shoppers, for a limited time only, Dempsey's Department Store is offering a complete line of cheap crap at extremely high prices. Come in today and be treated rudely by our poorly trained clerks. Remember, at Dempsey's, we're not just talking about the high cost of living, we're doing something about it. We're raising our prices. I'm not sure you've noticed it, but I'm always trying to improve society. And in my relentless pursuit, I feel the time may finally have arrived for me to address, have a nice day. I think we can agree it's gotten completely out of hand.
Just to give you some background on my long-standing interest in this subject, when I was a young man, we didn't have a nice day. It isn't that we didn't have nice days, of course. Offhand, I can remember several, most of them in 1949. But somehow we had them without any prompting. No coaching was necessary. The nice days just sort of happened. Perhaps at that time the days were simply nicer and we took them for granted. It could be that today's days leave much to be desired and actually need a little help. But if that's true, I'm not convinced that have a nice day is the best solution. And so, in my ongoing effort to elevate human experience, I think I've come up with an improved version of have a nice day. It's an alternative system of well-wishing, and frankly, something I hope will become the next big trend. But before I tell you about it, it's important to remind you that there's a limiting factor at work here. Most people have very little control over what sort of day they're going to have. For instance, when one person says, have a nice day, the other may well be thinking, I've just been diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and I'm also coughing up thick black stuff. In this case, the well-wisher's words will fall on deaf ears. And so, I feel that perhaps, in the interest of realism, instead of being directed arbitrarily to have a nice day, people should simply be encouraged to do the best they can. It's also probably unrealistic to expect someone to have a nice day all day long. How often does that happen? The day is simply too long and comprises too many parts. One's day may start off well enough, but quite often the niceness is difficult to sustain over an extended period of time. And so, instead of the now standard and far too general, have a nice day, I have devised a new, more specific system of selective short-term well-wishing that puts much less pressure on the recipient. In my system, the time of day a person offers good wishes determines what should be said. As an example, under my method, if I run into an acquaintance at 9 a.m., I'm likely to say, have a satisfying mid-morning. I believe in getting someone off to a good start, and it's a modest enough goal to suggest at such an early hour. Had the encounter taken place a bit earlier, I may have been inclined to offer a simple yet cheerful, here's wishing you a refreshing post-sleep phase. And turning the clock back even further, if the two of us had been out late and parted at 3 in the morning, I'm sure I would have told him to have yourself a stimulating pre-dawn. As you can see, I'm fully prepared for any time of day. 12 noon, you may ask? May your midday be crammed with unfettered joy and myriad delights. 2 in the afternoon? I hope you experience a rewarding post-lunch. Likewise, as the day draws to a close, can you guess what I tell a person at 5:30 in the afternoon? Enjoy your sundown. It's short, it's pleasant, it doesn't demand a lot. Here's one for the same time of day, which I reserve for more serious-minded friends. Have a profound dusk. I like it. I feel it shows a certain respect for the other fellow's depth of soul. Or, and this is a particular favorite of mine, have a challenging twilight. I enjoy giving the other person something to struggle with, just as happy hour is getting underway. By the way, I have a playful side as well. If my friend is a Scottish person, I may say, have a bonny gloaming, but not too often. I don't like to show off my command of foreign languages. Well, folks, I hope you've enjoyed this little explanation of my new system, but more important, I hope you'll put it to work in your daily lives. And so now, dear listener, as we prepare to take our leave, you may be tempted to think I'll be hard-pressed to offer a parting wish that hasn't already been suggested. Don't underestimate me. You see, I'm not limited to the short form. Occasionally, in an expansive mood, I get carried away, and my rhetoric becomes ornate. And so, as we part, let me state that I hope you have a memorable tomorrow, including, but not limited to, the promising golden hours of morning, the full rich bloom of afternoon, and of course the quiet gentle hours of evening, when time, pausing for an instant and breathing a small sigh, rushes forward to greet the newly forming day. I hope you appreciate the extra effort. At some point, someone who worked at Rockefeller Center must have said, "Boys, I have a great idea for Christmas. Let's kill a beautiful tree that's been alive for 75 years and bring it to New York City here. We'll stand it up in Rockefeller Plaza and conceal its natural beauty by hanging shiny, repulsive, man-made objects on it and let it stand there slowly dying for several weeks while simple-minded children stare at it and people from Des Moines take pictures of it. That way, perhaps we can add our own special obscene imprint to Christmas in Midtown. Regarding the criticism of Al Gore's actions upon being elected president in 2000, and realizing that the Bush family would do everything in its power to reverse the results illegally, I recall at the time hearing some of the usual morons in this country refer to President-elect Al Gore as a sore loser because he sought legal redress in the courts and he kept seeking it. Sore loser? You bet your fucking ass. What on earth is wrong with being a sore loser? It shows you cared about whatever the contest was in the first place. Fuck losing graciously. That's for chumps and losers, by the way. Americans have flat out lost their spirit. You see it everywhere. You ever watch these hockey assholes? When the game is over, they're forced to line up and shake hands with one another after spending 3 hours smashing each other in the mouth with sticks. Biggest load of shit I've ever witnessed. Whatever happened to in victory, magnanimity, in defeat, defiance? So said Frederick the Great. More about euphemisms. These days, people who have jobs are called members of the workforce. But I can't help thinking, the Russian Revolution would have been a lot less fun if the communists had been running through the streets yelling, "Members of the workforces of the world, unite!" And I'm sure Marx and Lenin would not be pleased to know that today employees who refuse to work no longer go out on strike. They engage in a job action that results in a work stoppage. And if a work stoppage lasts long enough, the company doesn't hire scabs. It brings in replacement workers. And when it comes to firing people, companies try desperately to depersonalize the process so that no human being is ever seen to fire another. The language is extremely neutral, and whatever blame there is goes to something called global market forces. Fucking foreigners. And these companies go through some truly exotic verbal gymnastics to describe what's taking place, although I'm not sure it makes the individuals in question feel any better. After all, being fired, released, or terminated would seem a lot easier to accept than being non-retained, dehired, or selected out. Nor would I be thrilled to be told that because the company was downsizing, right-sizing, or scaling down, I was part of an involuntary force reduction. I really don't care that my company is reshaping and streamlining, and that in order to manage staff resources, a focused reduction is taking place, and I'm one of the workers being transitioned out. Just fire me, please. I read somewhere that apparently one company's senior management didn't understand the fuss about this issue. After all, they said, all they were doing was eliminating the company's employment security policy by engaging in a deselection process in order to reduce duplication. By the way, when those deselected people begin to look for new jobs, they won't have to be bothered reading the want ads. Those listings are now called employment opportunities. Makes you feel a lot better, doesn't it? More euphemisms. American companies now put a great deal of effort into boosting their employees' self-esteem by handing out inflated job titles. Most likely they think it also helps compensate for the longer hours, unpaid overtime, and stagnant wages that have become standard. It doesn't. However, such titles do allow an ordinary store clerk to tell some girl he's picking up at a bar that he's a product specialist or a retail consultant. If it turns out she's a store clerk, too, but her store uses different euphemisms, then she may be able to inform him that she's a sales counselor or a customer service associate. And for a while there, they're under the impression that they actually have different jobs. These are real job titles, currently in use to describe employees whose work essentially consists of telling customers, "We're all out of medium." Nothing wrong with that, but it's called store clerk, not retail consultant, and not customer service associate. Apparently, stores feel they can charge more for merchandise sold by a customer service associate than they can for the same junk sold by a clerk. By the way, if a clerk should be unhappy with his title, he can always move to a different store, where he may have a chance of being called a product service representative, a sales representative, or a sales associate. And I hope you took note of that word associate. That's a hot word with companies now. I saw a fast food employee mopping the floor at an In-N-Out Burger, and I swear this is true, his name tag said associate. Okay? It's the truth. Apparently, instead of money, they now give out these bogus titles. At another fast food place, Au Bon Pain, I noticed the cashier's name tag said hospitality representative. The cashier! The name tag was pinned to her uniform. The people who sell these uniforms, by the way, now refer to them as career apparel, or even worse, team wear. I had to sit down when I heard that one. Team wear. Teams are also big in business, almost as big as associates. In Los Angeles's Cuckoo restaurants, the employees' name tags say team member. At a Whole Foods supermarket, I talked to the head of the meat department about ordering a special item. I figured he was the head butcher, but his name tag identified him as the meat team leader. Throw that on your resume. I guess the people under him would have been meat team associates. I didn't stick around to ask. So it's all about employee morale. And in a lot of companies, as part of morale building, the employees are called staff. But it's all right because most customers are now called clients. With those designations, I guess the companies can pay the staff less and charge the clients more. I'm not sure when all this job title inflation began, but it's been building for a while. At some point in the past 30 years, secretaries became personal assistants or executive assistants. Many of them now consider those terms too common, so they call themselves administrative aides. Everyone wants to sound more important these days. Teachers became educators. Drummers became percussionists. Movie directors became filmmakers. Company presidents became chief executive officers. Family doctors became primary care providers. Manicurists became nail technicians. Magazine photographers became photojournalists. Weightlifters became bodybuilders. And bounty hunters now prefer to be called recovery agents. And speaking of lifting, those retail store security people who keep an eye on shoplifters are known as loss prevention managers. Why not be a schmuck, a licensed practicing schmuck, or, if you qualify, a CPS, a certified public schmuck? It may not seem like it when you look around, but there's actually a shortage of schmucks in America. As a result, there's big money in schmucking. The average schmuck earns $28,000 a year, plus benefits, and there are openings for schmucks in every field. The government is run by schmucks, big business is run by schmucks, and the retail field is crawling with schmucks. And more and more, people are becoming independent, freelance schmucks on their own. Call the Schmuck Technical Institute today and get our free booklet, Hey, Putz, Be a Schmuck. Most people only manage to be schmucks at parties, but here's your chance to become a full-time, year-round schmuck. Give us a call. Don't be a schmuck. Be a schmuck. Here are my predictions for the future. In the future, the human lifespan will be extended to 200 years, but the last 150 will be spent in unremitting pain and sadness. No one will take drugs, but people will still buy them and conceal them from the police. Children will be required to attend school only when something comes up in conversation they do not understand. All people will speak the same language, but no one will speak it well. Science will develop exotic flowers capable of producing music. Most of these plants will be exploited by record companies. All farming will cease, and the land will be used for loitering. Although people will not keep pets of any kind, someone will still occasionally step in dog shit. A race of people living in the center of the earth will be discovered when one of them comes out to buy a sun lamp. Miners will exploit the ocean floor, and when trapped in a mine, the wives who gather to wait at the entrance will be forced to tread water. A team of astronauts will attempt to harness a comet and never be seen again. The human body will develop fins and gills, and beach property will increase tenfold in value. Man will learn to control the weather with a large hammer. A time machine will be built, but no one will have time to use it. At birth, religions will charge people an initial fee of $50,000 and then pretty much leave them alone. All the knowledge in the world will be contained on a single tiny silicon chip, which someone will misplace. People will be born with just enough money to last until they get seriously ill. The speed of the Earth's rotation will increase, and everyone less than 5 feet tall will be flung off into space, including Paul Anka. The sun's light will diminish until it is the equivalent of a 40-watt bulb, and people with highly developed squinting skills will have a survival advantage. Every part of the human body will become replaceable, but all parts will be back-ordered for 6 months. A utopian society ruled by women will emerge, and there will be peace and plenty for all. However, many men will still act like macho assholes. People will change clothes every 6 minutes, but still never be quite happy with their appearance. Cities will be built under huge glass domes, which in time will be completely covered by graffiti. Chickens will operate on gasoline, and surprisingly, many of them will get good mileage. Genetic scientists will develop vegetables too big to be transported, and they will have to be eaten right at the farm. The insane will no longer be housed in asylums. Instead, they will be displayed in department store windows. The oceans will dry up, and people will find things they dropped in the toilet many years ago. There will be no doctors or medicines of any kind, and everyone will be really sick. Eventually, it will no longer be necessary to forecast the future, because time will disappear and everything will happen at once. You ever notice this? Whenever we go into some country we've bombed, burned, and occupied, we always find mass graves full of dead people who were killed by the deposed dictator before we got there. And everybody in the United States acts like they're real surprised and disgusted. But when you think about it, what's a guy supposed to do with all those bodies after he's killed a couple of thousand people? Dig a separate hole for each one? Put up little markers with their names on them? Get real, for Christ's sakes. The whole idea of killing a couple of thousand people all at once in one place is to save time. Besides, all the United States ever does is complain a little, take a picture, and then leave. So what's the fucking difference? You know what I find interesting? Landmines. Here are a few great statistics. Listen to this. There are 340 different types of landmines made by 100 different companies. Every day, that's every day, roughly 6,000 fresh mines are placed in the ground. Right now, there are 110 million landmines in 72 countries, and every 22 minutes, one of them explodes. 75 mines explode every day, and each month 700 people are maimed or killed. That's 26,000 people a year. Don't you find that interesting? And mines cost only $3 to make and to put in the ground, but they cost $100 to disarm and remove. If you tried to remove them all, it would cost $33 billion, and it would take 1,100 years. They cost $3 a piece, and they last indefinitely. Wouldn't it be nice if other products could make that claim? Here's another funny statistic. In Cambodia, one out of every 236 civilians is missing a limb or an eye from an exploded landmine. Cambodia now has 30,000 people with at least one missing limb. And they still have 4 million mines in the ground. It makes you wonder whether or not some unlucky one-legged Cambodian guy has ever stepped on a landmine with his good leg. I bet it's happened.
I'll bet anything there's some guy in Cambodia who has hit the lottery twice. I tried to think of what would be the most entertaining way of setting off a landmine, and I decided it would be to land on one while doing a cartwheel. Wouldn't that be weird to see? Makes you wonder if the high school cheerleading squads in Cambodia keep mine detectors handy. These are the kind of thoughts I have when I'm sitting home alone and things are slow.
Be a doctor in just 3 weeks. Yes, thanks to our accelerated learning program, you can be a doctor in just 3 weeks, and you only have to study 20 minutes a day, or become a dentist in just one afternoon. Don't like your present job? Don't fit into the current job market? Be a doctor or a dentist. It's easy. Call now and we'll include a nursing course for your wife. In fact, we can make your wife a nurse over the phone. Call Accelerated Medical School now. Don't be an asshole. Be a doctor.
I don't know. Or at least I don't know if I know. And I don't even know if I care to know if I know.
I don't know what you mean.
You know, I mean, I don't know what I mean. You know what I mean?
What do you mean you don't know what you mean? I don't know what you mean.
I mean, you know, I don't know.
You don't know? You mean that?
I don't know.
Here we have a news story that took place over time. Chicago, May 1st. Police announced today they have found evidence of a murder dismemberment. In a north side dumpster, they have found a right arm, a left leg, and the eyebrows of an adult white male. Police say the eyebrows are bushy and had recently been plucked. According to spokesmen, the search for additional body parts will continue. May 6th. Here is further news on that north side dismemberment. Police have now found a set of blonde sideburns, a lower lip, two matching buttocks, a middle finger, a knee, and 2.5 grams of armpit hair. As yet, they have no identification, but sources say they're glad that at least it's still only one person they appear to be finding. May 12th. More on the dismemberment story. The police theory that they were dealing with only one body was shattered today when they discovered 44 male nipples in a vending machine. 26 of the nipples have hair, 18 do not. One of them has a nipple ring inscribed Lonnie and Marie. They also have come across a belly button, a calf, and several hundred warts, all found in a Hooters parking lot. Lint from the belly button leads police to believe the Naval's owner was wearing a plaid shirt. The investigation continues. May 23rd. Here is the latest from the north side. Police are now puzzled as to just how many bodies are involved. Today they found an Adam's apple, a hunchback, 6 heels, a pair of unmatching nostrils, a large bag of freckles, 2 dozen additional belly buttons, a blonde goatee, half a neck, and a suitcase full of knuckles. They say all the knuckles have recently been cracked. Cannibalism may be involved, as police have found a rib cage that shows traces of barbecue sauce. Letter to a friend. Dear Manny, it was great to see you at the hospital last Sunday. You looked good and sounded very positive about yourself. Each time I visit, I can see how much you've improved. I will say, though, it was a lot more fun when you were really fucked up and couldn't remember anything. Sincerely, Arlo. Here are today's cooking tips from Krellingford's Family Restaurant. Hamburger meat that has become slightly hardened by sitting at room temperature for more than 9 days can be perked up by soaking it in a mixture of gasoline and varnish remover. Soak the meat overnight and leave it in the sun for several days. Be sure to add a lot of extra hot spices to offset the gasoline taste. Then try to put the meat to use immediately. By the way, food prepared this way should never be cooked over an open flame. Here's another valuable cooking tip. You can prepare a delicious stew with just a volleyball, an old fatigue hat, and 6 gallons of bath water. Put the ingredients in a big pot and cook for 36 hours or until the volleyball is tender. Serves 12. Excellent with broccoli or corn. Try it over the holidays when the people you serve it to are people you don't see too often. That's it, folks. Remember, these cooking tips are brought to you by Krellingford's, the home of the ham and cheese caramel cornflake surprise. Why not drop by and take a chance? No one lives forever.
Uncle D'Artagnan was known as a fancy Dan because he circumcised himself with pinking shears. His wife, Velveeta, the only woman ever to go down on Newt Gingrich, claimed that to the very end D'Artagnan wore a golden tassel on his penis. He once told me that as a young man he caught the clap from one of the Doublemint twins and gave it to the other one on the same night. He was a lot of fun. He could make his cat shit by pointing the TV remote at it and pressing the volume button. His hobby was falling to the floor in hotel lobbies and pretending to have a stroke. Eventually, he was beaten to death with a cello by a classical musician he befriended at a juice bar. Uncle Tonto had a tough life. Intercourse with a pelican is not an easy thing to live down. He drank excessively. One time he was so hungover he had to consult a cottage cheese carton to determine the approximate date. At parties, he was the designated drinker, his preference being creme de menthe, sterno, and goat droppings. When stopped and tested by police, he usually set the breathalyzer on fire. Refusing to drive when he was sober, in the mornings he rode to work on an electric floor buffer, claiming the one drawback was the time he wasted traveling from side to side. He was sentenced to 10 years for defecating in a cathedral, but was released immediately when the warden felt Tonto was lowering the prison standards. After his release, he hitchhiked through Pennsylvania, where he was beaten to death by a buggy load of Quakers. Uncle Judas, a man smaller than life, never had a heyday. He peaked in third grade. Not only did opportunity fail to knock, it had deliberately thrown away his address. His existence was so boring, he once proudly showed me his neighbor's parking space. In an effort to improve his life, he decided to sell his soul. Unfortunately, he sold it on eBay and was never paid. He didn't accomplish much. His autobiography was entitled, What Do You Want From Me? One thing he did take pride in, he was one of the few men who, at the age of 85, could still remember the names of all his dentists. He died on the feast of St. Dismas, after mistakenly eating a bag of after-dinner mints before lunch. Uncle Montezuma wasn't too bright. He thought Irving Berlin was the Jewish section of Germany. As a young man, he wanted to be a gynecologist, but claimed he couldn't find an opening. He was proud of the fact that while serving a prison term for sodomizing a prairie dog, he learned to drink beer through his nose. For years he managed a gay car wash, but lost all his money investing in a roadside sausage museum. His last job was managing a Playboy club in Auschwitz. When he retired, he wasn't given a gold watch, but his former boss would call him once a week and tell him what time it was. Finally, after marrying a woman who had repeatedly blown Strom Thurmond during a military funeral, he died from eating a batch of carelessly made hollandaise sauce. More euphemisms. There's no part of American life that hasn't been soiled by the new, softer, artificial language. It's everywhere. When you travel, you notice it in the hotel business, or, as they prefer to think of themselves now, the hospitality industry. And by the way, hotels are one more place where you'll run into job title inflation. There was a time in a hotel when you checked in with the desk clerk. Now he's the front desk agent. When he answers the phone, he becomes guest services. I guess it's only fair. Everyone else in the hotel has been upgraded. The bellhop has somehow become a luggage assistant, and he claims to work in luggage services. The maids have been upgraded several times over the years. Cleaning woman, maid, housekeeper, now they're room attendants. And on the subject of rooms, depending on where you're staying, room service is likely to be called in-room dining or private dining. One brochure I read called it your private dining experience. Pretentiousness. Never underestimate the role pretension plays when it comes to creating euphemistic language. Here's another example of it. At one hotel where I stayed, the restaurant was temporarily located on the lower level. I was told the reason was that they were undergoing restaurant enhancement. Okay? The concierge actually uttered that phrase. Not remodeling. Restaurant enhancement. And he said it as if it was something people say all the time. By the way, I shouldn't have to remind you that that lower level he referred to was once called the basement. I guess I don't really mind the phrase lower level. At least it's descriptive. Although it is the comparative form, and not an absolute. Lower than what? It also bothers me when they tell me the gym is located on level 3. Level 3 is just plain old pretentiousness. And I wish the hotels would make up their minds on what to call the gym. It's been everything. Gym, fitness center, exercise room, health club, spa. God, spa! Used to be you had to go to Europe to find a spa. Now any place that has a sink and more than 3 towels is a fucking spa. And one more thing about hotels. A lot of them have replaced the Do Not Disturb signs with signs that say, Privacy, please. Seems like a small thing, but there's a difference here that's worth noting. Do Not Disturb is assertive. It's strong. Do not disturb. It means go away. But Privacy, please, is weak. It sounds as if you're pleading with people. Privacy, please? Softness. To my mind, it's one more example of the feminization of language that has taken place in this country. And more important, it represents a retreat from reality. Here's another example of the same problem. Thank you for not smoking. Now, speaking strictly for myself, I find nothing wrong with the phrase, no smoking. It's simple, it's direct, it's firm. No smoking. Any questions? Fine. But thank you for not smoking. First of all, it's weak. And second, for God's sakes, why are you thanking them? It's as if you think they're doing you a favor by not giving you emphysema. Personally, if I were trying to discourage people from smoking, my sign would be a little different.